Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about international institutions, specifically their impact on the likelihood of conflict. We talked earlier in the module about how international institutions can, at times, facilitate cooperation that wouldn't otherwise occur, though they probably can't overcome the greatest obstacles to cooperation, namely collaboration problems. I'm going to make a pretty similar claim this time around. That is, I'm going to argue that international institutions can sometimes prevent conflicts that would otherwise occur, but there are important limits to their ability to do so. More specifically, as you can see on the first slide, I'm going to discuss the ability or inability of international institutions to solve the specific problems that I've identified as potential causes of war. Those stemming from an inability to commit to a particular course of action, such as abiding by an agreement or offering greater concessions in the future than their newly acquired strength would otherwise dictate, and those caused by the fact that it's hard to know what terms a state will accept or reject, not least because they have no incentive to admit that they'd grant larger concessions, if that is in fact the case. Then I'm going to demonstrate that international institutions don't need to solve these problems in order to have a positive impact, nor do they need to have any independent means of enforcing their will. As long as they have the ability to monitor behavior, which no one really disputes that they do, they can reduce the likelihood of both war and the pursuit of policies that violate international norms or threaten the status quo. Let's start with commitment problems. As I said previously, there are two ways these can cause war. We only went through one in detail because the other wasn't too difficult to understand, but both are important. I'm actually going to present a game theoretic model of the more straightforward one later on, though, because it's going to be useful here to get a bit more specific about exactly how that works and when. So we might ask whether and when institutions can address each type of commitment problem, those having to do with monitoring compliance and those driven by future shifts in power. And the answer would be a qualified yes in both cases. Institutions can, and often do, provide for close monitoring of compliance with agreements. For example, one of the key provisions of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union, whose final implementation resulted in the removal of about 80% of all strategic nuclear weapons then in existence, was a complex monitoring and verification scheme. Of course, as I argued in the optional lecture on arms races, we would have expected the arms race between these two states to start winding down at around that point anyway. That is, we have to keep in mind the epiphenomenal critique of international institutions, introduced back in the lecture on institutions and cooperation. Higher levels of trust likely account for both the willingness to sign a treaty that carries with it provisions for invasive and extensive monitoring, as well as reductions in nuclear arsenals. But I think it's reasonable to conclude that the treaty would have been somewhat less successful without the monitoring provision, even if the very fact that it was negotiated in the first place says a lot about where relations stood between the superpowers at that point. The structure of the United Nations, particularly the veto power granted to the permanent members of the Security Council, can also be seen as mitigating commitment problems, specifically those stemming from future shifts in power. So can the voting rules within the other major institutions established at the end of World War II, such as the IMF and the GATT, now the WTO. The then dominant states, the U.S. and its allies, designed these institutions to ensure that they would have disproportionate influence over decision-making well into the future. Insofar as these institutions affect who gets what internationally, and they do, to a degree, by deciding when and where peacekeeping operations will be deployed to stabilize regional conflict, bailing governments out of financial crises, which generally means ensuring that the foreign creditors get back what they're owed, and determining which trade barriers will be lowered and which allowed to remain, they tend to steer things in a direction that benefits those who are already on top. For that reason, states that are on the rise now, but were less powerful then, like China, India, and Brazil, often call for reform of these institutions. Note that while China has a seat on the Security Council, they have much less influence in the IMF and WTO. If they were to get their way, the U.S. would have a slightly stronger incentive to wage preventive war against them. I'm not saying it's good that these institutions have the voting rules that they do, or arguing against reform, but the very thing that's being protested, the fact that these institutions are organized in such a way as to guarantee that greater benefits flow to the U.S. and its allies than to developing states, might help explain why the U.S. hasn't felt the need to slow the rise of potential future challengers by resorting to war the way others have in the past. Finally, we have UN peacekeeping. But first, let's address the question of what makes civil wars so different from interstate wars. Peacekeeping operations are sometimes authorized during and after interstate wars, but this is relatively rare. Most of what the UN does when it comes to peacekeeping, it does in states that have experienced or are currently experiencing a civil war. So you can't really talk about peacekeeping without talking about civil war. And though I'll have a lot more to say about civil war later, it's worth talking a bit about now as well. Many have argued that civil wars tend to last longer than interstate wars, which they do, by a lot, because governments so often seek a monopoly on the legitimate use of force, and accordingly, often demand that rebel groups lay down arms as part of any peace agreement. That is, part of what makes a state, or at least a legitimate one in the eyes of its people and the international community, is that no other force within its borders is capable of using violence without necessarily needing to fear retaliation. No government is likely to accept, then, under any but the most extreme of circumstances, the presence of armed forces that are neither theirs nor those of an ally. If a rebel group gives in to the demand that it lay down arms, though, the government is free to renege on the terms of the peace agreement without much consequence. Thus, it is likely to impose its most preferred outcome, which may mean genocide. I argued back in the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict that if we're to explain war, we must explain why a more efficient means of arriving at an undisputed allocation was not selected, because they often are. And when they are, they tend to reflect the expected outcome of fighting to a considerable degree. One side may be able to leverage the other's satisfaction with the status quo to extract somewhat greater concessions, but the expected outcome of war is often a key component of any agreement we expect to be reached in equilibrium. Well, when it's two states negotiating over territory, there's no problem. They're both going to keep their militaries, and so if the other side should try to take territory that was not allocated to them under the peace agreement, the side they're taking the territory from is free to resist. the threat of them doing so generally prevents such violations and makes peace self-enforcing, at least once everyone's in agreement about how the war would end if they were to go back to fighting. But when a central government demands that a separatist group lay down arms as part of an agreement that might reflect the relative strength of the rebels at the time, the rebels know that once they do lay down arms, there's nothing to stop the government from going right back to the status quo, or worse, punishing the region for supporting the separatists in the first place. That means that if they choose peace, there will be a rapid shift in power favoring the government. If they keep fighting and remain armed, the outcomes they can expect in the future look a lot better. Put simply, war-ending agreements between states are often credible because the threat of returning to war deters opportunistic violations. But agreements between governments and groups they seek to disarm, as they usually do, generally are not credible, unless a third party can protect the rebels from the government, or at least give them some warning that they're in danger. That's where peacekeeping comes in. That's not the only reason we might expect peacekeeping to be effective. When one or both sides is not in complete control of all the agents of violence, accidents can happen. That is, when tensions are high and trust is low, loud noises get mistaken for gunshots, and what was meant as retaliatory fire can look like provocation. Next thing you know, things are spiraling out of control. Or, if some members of one of the groups are dissatisfied with the peace agreement because they think they could have gotten a better deal, they may destabilize the agreement intentionally. In situations like that, simply putting a buffer between the two sides can defuse tensions. That's sort of solving a commitment problem, but not one we've discussed up until now, seeing as we've been treating both sides as unitary actors for the sake of simplicity. I should also say that UN peacekeepers are not the only third party that can stop the government from slaughtering the rebels after they've laid down arms. States can, and often have, served this role as well. That's worth acknowledging, but doesn't really contribute much to our discussion of how and when international institutions affect the likelihood of armed conflict, so we'll set it aside. The larger point is that peacekeeping, as opposed to peace imposition, which we'll talk about in just a minute, is an area where international institutions, like the UN, can solve commitment problems. They can monitor compliance with the terms of the agreement, and they can prevent the rapid shift in power that comes with laying down arms by promising to protect the rebels in the event that the government seeks to wipe them out once they've surrendered. But these are issues that arise once a war is over. Solving commitment problems to help produce peace between actors with a genuine interest in peace is one thing. Forcing an end to fighting when the parties have little interest in peace, that's what's meant by peace imposition, is quite another. Until very recently, peacekeeping operations have been very lightly armed, so much so that they haven't always succeeded at preventing mass slaughter. For example, towards the end of the Bosnian War, 8,000 Bosnian Serb forces surrounded the UN safe area of Srebrenica and told the 400 Dutch peacekeepers inside that they could either leave or stay and die along with the Bosniak Muslim population inside the city. Predictably and tragically, they left, and one of the worst massacres Europe has seen in my lifetime resulted. Thankfully, that's a bit of an unusual case, but the general point still stands. We can expect the UN to prevent a return to fighting once a war ends. We have a clear sense of what the mechanism is there, what specific problem they solve, and how they're able to solve it despite their limited resources. but we ought to expect them to fail when they seek to do more than that. On the next slide, you see a summary of the data used by a recent study to evaluate precisely these claims. This study went about things a bit differently than I've done in any of the statistical analysis I've shared with you. The authors used a fancy technique known as matching. We're not going to get into the details of what that is or how exactly it works, which would be well beyond the scope of this module, but I'll try to clarify the intuition behind it. Basically, the authors didn't look at all possible cases, the way I usually do when performing statistical analysis, but a subset that they had reason to think would allow for something closer to an apples-to-apples comparison. You can see at the bottom of the slide the list of cases they compare to one another. I'm not going to talk you through those tables, but I thought some of you might be curious, so it's there if you want to take a look. As we discussed back in the lecture on statistical analysis, there's reason to believe that even if peacekeeping was always partially effective, it would look like it wasn't to anyone who simply compared the experiences of states that received a peacekeeping operation to those that didn't, without taking into account the other important differences between them. That is, I argued that the fragility or stability of a war-ending agreement might influence both whether a peacekeeping operation gets sent in and the likelihood of a new war, and might therefore represent a classic example of a Z affecting both X and Y. That's a problem that matching is meant to solve. It's not guaranteed to do so by any stretch of the imagination, but sometimes it helps. Aside from that, everything is pretty straightforward. The authors look at the pattern of association between a variable that indicates whether UN peacekeeping operations were sent in, on the one hand, and the duration of either war, if this was an attempt at peace imposition, or of post-war peace, if it was traditional peacekeeping. And the argument I just laid out is that we should expect to see a positive association in the latter case, because peacekeeping can often solve commitment problems that might otherwise threaten the stability of post-war peace, but no association in the former case, because until the parties have figured out what the terms of a war-ending agreement should be, their ability to commit to it is less relevant, and the UN can't really help with that. Unsurprisingly, that's just what we find when we look at the table of results on the next slide. Yes, it looks like there's a negative pattern of association between peacekeeping and the duration of ongoing civil wars, but that's not statistically significant. On the other hand, we see a positive and statistically significant association between peacekeeping and the duration of post-war peace. Incidentally, the size of the latter effect is rather impressive. The authors estimate that it's only 14% as likely that a new war will break out if a peacekeeping operation was sent in after the war ended than if one wasn't. That is, if we took a country that had recently experienced a civil war, one for which the baseline probability of a new war breaking out in any given month was 0.2, it would drop to about 0.03 if a UN peacekeeping operation was sent in. 20% chance versus a 3% chance. That's huge. Okay, so international institutions can sometimes solve commitment problems. It's in that capacity that they probably played a small role in ending the Cold War arms race, potentially prevented a preventive war between the US and China, and have prevented a return to fighting in many post-Civil War states. Now let's talk about information problems. The problem here, if that didn't come across fully in the lecture on information problems, is not simply that states don't know what terms their adversaries will accept or reject, but that their adversaries have every incentive to lie about that. That may seem like an obvious point. Indeed, that's why I didn't bring it up in that lecture explicitly. But I'm about to argue that international institutions aren't very good at preventing wars by solving information problems. And some of you might wonder why that is, given that I've already argued that they're capable of monitoring compliance with agreements. If they can reveal information in that sense, why not in this one? The critical difference is that both sides know that neither one of them benefits from the existence of a commitment problem. The same can't be said of information problems. When a war occurs, it's because the defender wasn't lying when they said they'd never let the challenger have X overline. But the challenger didn't know that, couldn't have known that, because the defender would have said the same thing even if they were willing to give in to that demand. Even if they were willing to, they still wouldn't have wanted to. Not if they could convince the challenger to demand X underline instead. In other words, information problems are problems that can't easily be solved because one side potentially has a strong incentive to keep the problem in place. So how could international institutions help? They'd have to be able to reveal things to the challenger about the defender that the challenger doesn't already know and the defender wants to keep secret. The odds of that aren't good. Actually, it's worse than that. Towards the end of the lecture, I'm going to argue that sometimes international institutions can do precisely that, specifically when it comes to providing evidence of misbehavior. Of things the defender tried to keep secret, yes, but which actually happened, and therefore can be documented. In the lecture on information problems, I argued that wars are often caused by uncertainty over how they would end, specifically as might result from uncertainty over the defender's martial effectiveness. It's not clear how international institutions can help with that. On the other hand, they don't really need to solve the problem if they can just make gambling less attractive. That is, if institutions can drive the effective costs of war up, either by making war itself even worse or by providing benefits that can only be enjoyed if the two sides remain at peace, they can reduce the likelihood of war. Again, there are recent studies that help support the arguments I'm making. One of them looked at third-party mediation, whether done by states or international institutions, and found that if the only strategy was to provide information, there's generally no effect. However, when mediation attempts involve a mix of carrots and sticks, intended to make gambling less attractive, the track record is much better, as we'd expect. Similarly, many studies have found that wars occur less often between states with higher levels of economic cooperation, and this is often thought to be because the benefits of cooperation effectively increase the costs of war. Insofar as bilateral and regional trade agreements facilitate cooperation that would not otherwise occur, and I tried to convince you in a previous lecture that we've good reason to believe they do, such institutions may well prevent wars. Granted, in a lot of cases, these agreements are reached between states that weren't likely to go to war anyway, so I don't want to oversell this, but still. At this point, I've argued that international institutions can sometimes solve the problems that lead to war, though they often can't. I've also argued they don't necessarily need to solve those problems to make war less likely. I'm now going to develop that last point in greater detail, focusing less on manipulating the costs of war than an alternative mechanism. The basic idea is that international institutions don't need to punish bad behavior in order to deter it, so long as they increase the chance that someone does so. In other words, international institutions act a bit like CCTV cameras. If there's no one watching those cameras, they'd have no effect on whether people break the law. But there is, and so they do. Similarly, international institutions may not punish bad behavior, but they influence the likelihood that individual states will. Okay, on to the model. Again, we have just two states, a challenger and a defender. And the challenger is going to set the terms of any peaceful agreement by issuing a demand or executing a fait accompli or whatever. But they can also just attack outright in this model, as in the one from the Lectron commitment problems. The defender has more interesting options here than in the past, though. Not only must they decide whether to accept or reject the challenger's terms, assuming any were offered, but if they do accept, they must also decide whether to comply with those terms. If they reject X, a war occurs and the game ends. And for the sake of simplicity, we're going to say that it doesn't really matter when or why a war occurs. Whether it's because C attacked outright, D rejected C's terms, or C attacked in the second stage, the payoffs are the same for everyone. That's not necessarily realistic, but it helps demonstrate a unique path to war, one that has nothing to do with preventing power shifts or anything like that. It's when D accepts that things get interesting. Again, if they do so, they must decide whether to comply with the terms of the agreement or not. By assumption, any violation will take place in secret. So the challenger won't know for sure whether they're actually getting the concessions they demanded. Obviously, if we're talking about territory, as I often do, that makes no sense. It's not hard to tell whether you're in possession of disputed territory or not. But if C wants D to stop supporting terrorists, or providing illegal subsidies to some industry, or persecuting its own people, or enriching uranium, then it might very well make sense to assume that C can't tell for sure whether D has actually given in to their demands. They should, however, be able to make an educated guess. Specifically, I'm going to assume that if D is violating the terms of the agreement, if they didn't stop doing whatever it was that C objected to, there's some probability that C will find out. We'll call that probability alpha. In the real world, states have to figure out whether red flags mean anything or not. But the argument doesn't change much if we allow for that. The maths, however, do. So we'll say that C never sees any warning signs if everything is okay. The problem is, they don't always see them when they're not. So if they do see them, they know that D is misbehaving. But if they don't, they can't necessarily be sure. For the sake of simplicity, we'll assume that if the defender is misbehaving, and the challenger doesn't do anything about it, that gives C a payoff of 0, and D a payoff of 1. But if C chooses not to go to war, and D did in fact make the concession that C demanded of them, then C enjoys a level of satisfaction equal to the size of that demand, whereas D subtracts the demand from their initial payoff of 1. Nothing new there. This version of the model is a bit more complicated than some versions, but it's not too messy. We don't even have different types. C makes a demand, or not, and then D either gives in or resists. If D gives in, they either follow through by actually changing their behavior, or they keep doing the bad thing in secret. There's some chance that C catches them, if so, and some chance that they get away with it. The payoffs are what you'd expect if you've been following everything up until this point. If an agreement is reached and implemented, C gets what they asked for. If there's a war, C imposes their will as best they can, etc. Let's talk about what happens in equilibrium. There are two possibilities here, and thankfully, they don't overlap. If we put hard numbers on everything, the model tells us what will happen. One possibility, which exists when C's not too likely to catch D misbehaving, is that C simply attacks D at the start of the game, launching what we might think of as a preemptive war. They don't even give D the chance to comply with the agreement, because it's obvious that they won't. There'd be no reason for them to, when they're that likely to get away with not doing so. More formally, this happens when alpha is less than alpha hat, which is defined there for you. Note, as it says on the slide, Q is being used here to stand for the probability that D actually complies with an agreement it has accepted. The next possibility is that C does not attack immediately, but they will if they catch D misbehaving, which might happen because D only sometimes complies. Let's plug some numbers in. Imagine that W is 0.7 and both cost terms are 0.2. At one extreme, with Q equal to 0, meaning that the challenger has no expectation of the defender complying with the terms of an agreement, alpha hat would come to 1. That would mean that C would have to be absolutely certain that they would detect any violation before they decide not to go to war. What if Q were 1, though, indicating that D is certain to comply? Then alpha hat would be about 0.55. What if Q was 0.5? Then alpha hat would be about 0.714. So the more likely it is that the defender will keep doing what it's been doing, the more confident C needs to be that they can detect bad behavior before they'd allow any chance of D taking advantage of them. What does any of this have to do with international institutions? Well, suppose that institutions can monitor behavior. They can't punish anyone, they have no enforcement capabilities, but they can increase the chances that D will get caught if they misbehave. They can increase alpha, in other words. And what happens when we increase alpha? Well, it's more likely that we find ourselves in the wait-and-see equilibrium than the one where the challenger goes to war straight away. Moreover, though you can't tell this from the information on the slide, it turns out that the size of the concession D makes, when they do in fact make a concession, is bigger. So increasing alpha makes war less likely, and, on average, not in all cases, brings D's behavior more in line with international expectations. So even if international institutions can't punish bad behavior, as long as they can detect it, even imperfectly, they promote peace and limit violations of international norms and threats to the international status quo. Granted, institutions probably don't help much when the agreement we're worried about someone cheating on is meant to prevent nuclear proliferation, because states are already paying pretty close attention to that issue themselves. It's hard to imagine a violation of such an agreement getting past Washington, but not getting past the UN. But we might be more optimistic about international institutions deterring bad behavior when it comes to, say, human rights violations, especially mass killings. Both IGOs, that's international governmental organizations, and INGOs, non-governmental, keep close tabs on such violations, and the very fact that they pay attention to such things and issue reports about them has almost certainly prevented some atrocities from occurring in the first place.